is Democracy Now.
This was Indonesian military headquarters. They had the militias in the back, and from where they were holding me on the second floor, you could see the militiamen going out to do their raids, set fire to the city. And so this was the place from which the Indonesian military coordinated the destruction of East Timor.
Journalist Alan Nairn returns to Dili for Independence Day. We'll go back to his reports of September 1999, when the Timorese voted for independence and the Indonesian military and militias burned East Timor to the ground. We'll hear the justifications of Clinton, Kissinger, and Holbrooke, and then a State Department official who refused to go along. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, broadcasting live from Dili, East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman. Democratic Party leaders in the United States and some Republicans are demanding a public investigation of the Bush administration's handling of intelligence before September 11th, following revelations that Bush had been warned by the CIA last summer of the danger of hijackings by people affiliated with Osama bin Laden. Pakistan police say they believe they found the remains of murdered U.S. journalist Daniel Pearl. Israeli tanks swept through the Jenin refugee camp again this morning amid heavy gunfire. The army's earlier attack on the camp gave rise to an international outcry. Close to half the people who died in the attack were civilians. Meanwhile, International Solidarity Movement activist Kristen Schur returned to her home in New York last night. She's one of the peace activists who made it into Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity while it was besieged by Israeli soldiers. After the siege ended, the Israeli troops arrested all the activists inside and held them in prison without charges. Most of the activists went on hunger strike in protest. They asked not to be deported so that they could return of their own free will. But Kristen Schur was deported. She joins us now in the Firehouse studio in New York. Kristen, tell us your story.
Hi. I just got back into the States last night. I was taken out of the Church of the Nativity by the IDF, drug out, and put inside a bus where I was searched, and my film was destroyed by the IDF, and my mini discs were taken. They wanted to make sure that we didn't get any information out about what was going on inside the church, what really happened. So then I was taken to a jail in the Mali Duman settlement, which is outside of Jerusalem, where Palestinians have been removed from their homes and put 2 miles away in an area which is essentially a garbage dump. So this jail is in the center of a settlement that is an illegal Israeli settlement. And I was held there for 3 days. We were hunger striking. There were 3 women activists in total in that jail. We were never told what the charges were against us. We were never officially arrested. We had our pictures taken. We resisted the photographing as best we could, and actually the police woman who was yanking our heads back for the photograph has a very clear shot in the photos, but we're pretty unclear. Our faces are pretty unclear in the shot. So I was held there for 3 days, and then without being told why or where I was going, I was shackled again and put inside the back of another police van and driven to a prison outside Tel Aviv called Ramli. And in there I was held for 4 days. In all these places I was strip searched several times, had my belongings gone through, and was generally just harassed and intimidated. I was not allowed to make phone calls, not allowed even to talk to the U.S. consulate, who I repeatedly tried to talk to just to have somebody be working on our behalf to get us out. I mean, our intention was to not leave until the Israelis had left Bethlehem, and we were not going to leave the church until the Israelis left Bethlehem because we knew that we would be arrested and deported if they got hold of us. So they came in and got us out of the church, and we were deported. The charge is sort of loose, and I don't know if it's official or not, but it's conspiring with the enemy. So because we brought food and supplies into the Church of Nativity, where there were, by the time we got there, about 150 Palestinians who had been without food or proper water or electricity for 40 days in total. So when we got there, it was, about maybe 30 days. they had nothing, and we brought in food supplies and some international attention and hopefully some pressure. And instead of being allowed to do that, we were called conspirators, and we were arrested and drug out.
Kristen, we hope to definitely have you back next week to go more extensively into the reasons why you went into the church, why you went to Israel and the occupied territories. But finally, can you go back now?
I'm not allowed to go back ever. The judge told me that she never wanted me to go to Israel, that I was not allowed to be there, that I had broken international law by going into a closed military zone, and that what I did politically was interfere with an Israeli operation, and that Israel wanted nothing to do with me ever again. And I've been told that at the very least I'm not allowed to even try to reenter for 10 years. The American consulate told me even after 15 years there's no way I would be allowed to go back.
Kristen Schur, international solidarity movement activist, again was deported from Israel after spending the last weeks at the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. You are listening to Democracy Now!
I lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
East Timor, annihilation to a new nation. Tune in to Democracy Now! Beginning May 13th, broadcasting from East Timor.
Converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire on the people.
Well, we pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights.
Military assistance programs expose the trainees to democratic ideas and humanitarian standards.
I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor. We have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable.
I was informed by Colonel Sugianto. He was a top officer in the Jakarta administration, that America had given the green light for Indonesia to invade Timor.
From East Timor, this is Democracy Now!
I am Amy Goodman, and it's 3 days until East Timor's historic independence. Yesterday, we looked at the history of East Timor from Indonesia's invasion in 1975 to its quarter century of U.S.-supported occupation, to the military's killing of 200,000 Timorese, a third of the population, and the November 12, 1991 Santa Cruz massacre, in which Indonesian soldiers gunned down more than 270 Timorese. Today, we move ahead to August and September of 1999, when the people of East Timor voted in an historic UN-sponsored referendum for their independence. After the vote, the Indonesian military burned East Timor to the ground. We now know that the United Nations and the United States knew from the start that the Indonesian military and its militias were created to sabotage East Timor's referendum through terror and intimidation. In 1999, Democracy Now! Devoted extensive coverage to East Timor's referendum and Indonesia's campaign of terror against the Timorese. We began on May 5th when I questioned UN Secretary General Kofi Annan at the news conference announcing the UN agreement that gave Indonesia's military killers responsibility for the security of the vote.
This is a historic moment. I am delighted to tell you that we have just signed the three agreements on East Timor, as you saw, between the Republic of Indonesia and the Republic of Portugal. We are now moving immediately on the next phase. The United Nations staff are already on their way to the region to begin preparing for the popular consultation. All of us are determined to ensure that it is free, fair, and thorough. If we are to fulfill that pledge, the United Nations must be able to work freely and in an atmosphere of security. Security in East Timor is a responsibility of the Indonesian government.
How can you say that Indonesia will be in charge of the security when it's been the perpetrator of the violence in East Timor for 23 years and killed about 200,000 Timorese, number one? So what is going to be done about keeping the Indonesian military away from the Timorese when they are voting to protect them? And how many UN personnel will be brought in to protect the Timorese against the Indonesian military?
First of all, let me be quite clear here. I think we have been engaged in this kind of operations and peacekeeping operations for a long time. We are also witnessing a situation even today in Kosovo. In each of these situations, in each operation that we get engaged in, whether it's elections in Namibia or elsewhere, we deal with the authorities. We deal with those in control. We deal with those who are responsible for the territories. If we do not deal with the Indonesian authorities and ask them to exercise their responsibility for law and order, whom do you suggest we turn to do that? Can the UN send in a force to do that at this stage without the agreement of the Indonesian authorities? We have to be realistic.
On August 30th, 1999, the people of East Timor turned out in overwhelming numbers to vote for their independence, defying a systematic campaign of Indonesian terror. Journalist Alan Nairn was in the capital of Dili through the August 30th vote and Indonesia's destruction of East Timor in the days that followed. The Clinton administration maintained its support for Indonesia's armed forces until the very end, when the world's attention and universal horror at Indonesia's killing spree forced the U.S. to cut military ties. The following is a collection of some of Alan Nairn's historic broadcasts of August and September 1999.
Well, this is, I think this is the beginning of the end of the occupation, and you really got that sense. Turnout was huge. People poured into the polling stations very early. The ones I visited, I went by about half a dozen of the polling places. People were very quiet, serious, but through the day, the mood seemed to pick up. People started smiling, laughing. You know, I think they realized how big this was. And I think that's really the key thing, because the militias, the army militias, have been threatening people with death if they vote for independence. You know, the UN has been running a publicity campaign saying, don't worry, this will be a secret vote. The army will not know how you voted. I think a lot of people do not believe that. I think a lot of people do believe that the army will somehow learn how they voted. But I think a lot of people have also made the decision, well, so be it. Even if the army finds out, they're going to go out and vote for independence anyway, because they do see this as a chance to end it and get the Indonesian army out and end the occupation. So it's a very dramatic time. You know, whole families were coming out. There seemed to be a shortage of middle-aged men at the polls, you know, because so many have been killed. You saw a lot of women with children, but no husbands. It's amazing, you know, in Timorese history. Everybody knows December 7th, 1975, that was the day of the invasion. Everybody knows November 12th, that was the 91 massacre that we survived and that really marked the beginning of the political turnaround because of international pressure and activism and the persistence of the Timorese that led to today. And now I think August 30th will go down as, you know, one of those landmark days. And militias besiege the UN headquarters. They attacked the neighborhood surrounding it and were shooting at Timorese who were trying to get into the UN compound. I was just at the Motael Church Clinic, where one of those who was shot during this attack, Roger Suarez, died on the operating table. He was 19 years old. He was shot by the military, according to the doctor. As they were attacking those outside the UN compound, they set fire to several small stores and buildings, including a place where they were selling gasoline. You could see the tower of smoke rising over Dili. And ironically, it was the same RIMAB, the one that had helped the BNP in the Liki Saa massacre. That was the unit that was called in to provide security for the UN compound. I just heard on the Australian TV news a commentator, a reporter, say that after the attack outside the UN compound, police have restored control of the area. Well, the problem is that the police have control of the area.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now.
Today, I was in the center of Dili. The central business district of Dili was completely burnt. The buildings were still smoking. The smoke was hanging in the air. They were charred. They had been looted. The only people on the street were Itariks and Indonesian military and police.
We get a live report from Dili as the United Nations announces they are pulling out of East Timor, leaving 1,000 refugees in their compound and a terrorized population throughout the country. We're joined now on the telephone by journalist Alan Nairn. He's the only American journalist left in East Timor. He is at the UN compound.
The word has gotten out that the UN will evacuate tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. our local time. Many Timorese are weeping, as are many of the Westerners. Many people here say, and I agree, that this will mean death for many, perhaps a majority of these Timorese in the compound, and certainly many thousands of Timorese across the country.
All day long, and in fact for the two previous days, there had been a barrage of gunfire from automatic rifles, and in many cases heavy machine guns, detonations of small either bombs or mortar pieces, grenades going off all around the UN compound. It was just nonstop barrage. And this was also the time when the burning of Dili was at its peak. So even that day, in the daytime, you could barely see the sun because there was so much ash and smoke in the air and everyone could smell it. And it really did look like the result would be a massacre in the making if the UN pulled out and left the local staff. I'm sorry, left the refugees. So what happened was a lot of people rebelled, said, no, we're not leaving, regardless of what army you have come in to take us out. And that included many of the UN staff.
As a foreigner and a journalist, particularly an American journalist, I know that I enjoy a certain de facto political leeway that enables me to say things that local people would be killed for saying. I have tried to use that privilege to tell the truth about TNI Aubrey. If because of this the Army feels they must arrest or jail me, then I know that there is nothing I can do to stop them.
American journalist Alan Nairn, facing imprisonment or deportation from Indonesia, speaks from detention. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Driving me to the airport, you could just see more of burnt out Dili, the Coma Road, which goes to the airport. All, every single one of the is gone. The only major structure still standing there is the former Australian consulate, where the skeleton of the UN now is. That place is built like a fort, but just about everything else is burnt out. Plane was taking off and we were leaving Dili. I could see two major fires burning.
And in terms of loot that the Indonesian military is taking out?
Well, I was actually supposed to be flown out on a U.S. C-130, what they call Hercules, a big transport plane.
But the military escorts, they weren't me on that plane because it was full. It was just stuffed with, I couldn't for where these things came from, but it had, a lot of them had deep looted goods. There were things like gasoline engines and electric generators that had been ripped from where they were, been in. There were boxes and boxes of miscellaneous computer equipment and televisions. There was one entire truck, which a whole group of soldiers pushed into the cargo bay of the plane. So they were carrying a lot out of Timor. It was either looted stuff, or it was in with the plan laid out in the from the Office of Politics, the Ministry of Politics and Security, confidential memo that leaked about a month ago. And in that, they talked about how they would strip Timor of everything and destroy the facilities on the way out. And they certainly seem to be, to say the least. Here in Kupang, the person who's been a chief interrogator here, Mr. Soraya, said that there were 1,000 Timorese who are now East Timorese who are held in Kupang.
How many thousand?
Various.
How many thousand?
He said 40,000, 40.
Alan, when we come back from the break, we're going to play the statement that you read. But before we go into the break, can you tell us the circumstances that you wrote the statement in the last hours?
Well, today, the interrogation today was very long. It was about, I don't know, maybe 4 hours, 5 hours, something like that. And the way they do it is they make up a written form, a written statement, summarizing the questions and my answers. And when we got to item 18 in the Mr. Soraya said, should give my own response to the charges against me. He said that there's currently a debate among the ministers of the Carter government as to what to do with me. He said that some say face the jail term, which is based on showing me the regulations, 10 years maximum, and a $5 rupee a fine, or another in Jakarta, he said, we're saying it should just be tossed out of the country, which to me seems politically much more likely as to what they're actually going to do. But this was the, what you have the tape of is point 18 statement of the interrogation report, my chance to make my own statement. I started, as with every, he asked me that question, and I started to give my response, and he started to write. But after I had said the first sentence, and he had written down the sentence, he got very uneasy, and he said, well, why don't you just write down the rest? He didn't want to put it down in his own handwriting. This is point 18 of the interrogation report on me. This is the part where I get to respond to the charges. I'll just read it quickly. I know that the Army has put me on the blacklist. They did this because I watched their soldiers murder more than 271 people at the Santa Cruz Cemetery. This crime was the responsibility of the Indonesian Army Commander, General Tri Sutrisno, and the Minister of Defense, General Benny Mardani. The murders were committed with American M16 rifles. The American government also bears some of the responsibility because they have armed, trained, and given money to the TNI Aubrey, even though they knew that TNI Aubrey is led by murderers and is responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Timorese, Achenese, West Papuan, and Indonesian civilians. Because I survived the massacre and denounced the crime to the outside world, the TNI Aubrey and the Suharto government banned me as a, quote, threat to national security, unquote. That ban has been reaffirmed by each subsequent TNI Aubrey commander, including General Faisal Tanjung and General Wiranto. I do not think that I am a threat to the Indonesian or Timorese people. but I hope that I am a threat to General Wiranto, General Tanjung, and the other present and former leaders of the TNI ABRI. I believe that they feel threatened by anyone who would expose their crimes. General Wiranto and Generals Bombong, Zaki, and Shafi.
Alan Nairn, reporting in August and September of 1999. First, on the day of the historic referendum where the Timorese voted for their independence, and then through the days afterwards when the Indonesian military burned East Timor to the ground, drove out hundreds of thousands of Timorese from their homes, drove them over to the border, over the border into Indonesia. And then finally, reporting from his prison cell, where Alan Nairn was held first in East Timor, then moved to West Timor, which is a part of Indonesia, faced 10 years imprisonment. Ultimately, he was deported. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Alan Nairn will join us live. He's here in Dili, East Timor, for the historic day, just 3 days away, and that is the day that East Timor will become a new nation. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, broadcasting live from Dili, East Timor. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration's delegation to East Timor's independence celebration will be led by former President Bill Clinton and former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Richard Holbrooke, two men deeply involved in supporting Indonesia's occupation of East Timor. Journalist Alan Nairn has returned to East Timor's capital of Dili and joins us here to talk about Clinton and Holbrooke's history. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, we've been broadcasting here for a week. Before we go to Clinton and Holbrooke, your thoughts as you land in Dili?
Well, it's amazing to be in a free East Timor. You know, you still see camouflage soldiers on the streets, and I still get a jolt when I see them. But now they're sent in by the United Nations to oversee the transition to freedom. The Timorese have won a tremendous victory. They lost a third of their people, but now they're free. And I hope now that the same thing can happen to other people who were having their civilians slaughtered by occupation armies, by repressive armies. Timor is certainly an inspiring start.
So right now, in a few days, on Sunday, East Timor will be independent, and President Clinton, Richard Holbrooke are headed to East Timor for the Independence Day celebration. Why don't we begin by talking about President Clinton?
Well, Clinton supported the Indonesian military right up to the end. Soon after Clinton came to office, the Pentagon launched a program called JSAT in Indonesia, under which they sent in Green Berets, Air Force Commandos, U.S. Marines, armed. They sent them armed into Indonesia to teach things like demolition, surveillance, advanced sniper technique. They focused their training on Kopassus, the special forces killers who were responsible for some of the worst atrocities in Timor, and in fact are currently doing the same thing in Aceh, on the western end of Indonesia. At one point, Clinton actually brought General Suharto, the Indonesian dictator, into the Oval Office, where he was also greeted by Al Gore. He offered F-16s to Suharto. The next day, a White House official told the New York Times that Suharto was our kind of guy. When Suharto was falling, Clinton stuck with him, stuck by him to the very end, even after multinationals had pulled out of Indonesia. And in 1999, during the terror campaign, even though openly the Indonesian military had massacred through the militias, had massacred the church in Likisa, they had staged two rampages in downtown Dili, burning and looting along the way, Clinton continued military assistance to Indonesia. And it was only in the final days, when it became front page news that the Indonesian military was destroying Timor, only then, with the U.S. Congress and in open revolt, only then finally did Clinton cut off the military assistance. And Wiranto, the Indonesian commander, immediately backed down and said that the U.N.-backed international troops could come in, and that was the end of the occupation. If Clinton had done that years earlier, thousands of lives would have been saved.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because right before Clinton was elected president in the fall of 1992, I got a chance to question him when he gave a major foreign policy address in New York, and I asked him, would he consider cutting off aid to the Indonesian regime, given that they killed a third of the population of Timor, and that on November 12, 1991, they had gunned down more than 200 Timorese. This is what he had to say.
I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor, and I think we have to review it. I'm not prepared at the present time to say categorically we should cut off all aid, but I do believe we have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable. I think we have to engage the government on the question of how those people are being treated, and I certainly wouldn't rule out the prospect of cutting aid.
That was Clinton just before he was elected president. Your comment, and then we're going to move on to Richard Holbrooke.
Well, Clinton certainly didn't ignore Timor. He kept on sending weapons and training, in fact, new training, to the Indonesian military. It was Congress, responding to grassroots activist pressure, that continued cutting back on the weapons and training. And that severely weakened the Indonesian military. And it was one of the key factors that brought Habibie, the Indonesian president who followed Suharto, to the point where he decided this isn't worth it. We're going to allow the referendum in Timor, so in hopes of getting their military backing restored, which George W. Bush is now trying to do.
Now to Richard Holbrooke, who will join President Clinton on this Bush delegation to East Timor for the Independence Day celebration.
I was glad to see you acknowledge the U.S. role of being complicitous, as you put it, in the Indonesian invasion of East Timor. It was actually even slightly worse than you described. I interviewed President Ford and some of the Indonesian officials and others involved in the meetings just prior to the invasion, and it's clear from those discussions that the U.S. actually gave a green light for the invasion. However, you did not discuss your own role in the subsequent slaughter in East Timor. You were the Assistant Secretary of State in the Carter administration at the height of the genocide in Timor, the years of 76, 77, 78, 79, when the killing rose to a peak. And you were the Carter administration's point man on Timor policy. You handled the testimony before Congress and so on. And it was under your watch that the U.S. sent in the OV-10 Bronco planes, the low-flying planes, which we used to bomb and strafe the Timorese out of the hills. It was under your watch
this
that the U.S.
This is Richard Holbrooke being questioned by Alan Aaron in 1997.
From the hills. and put them in the prison and resettlement camps. Some of Mr. Ramos Horta's own brothers and sisters were killed with U.S. weapons during these attacks. Testimony from Catholic Church sources, reports from Amnesty International and others indicated that hundreds of thousands of East Timorese were killed during this period. And during this period, not only was the U.S. sending in these weapons, which were used to kill the Timorese, but it was also blocking the UN Security Council from taking enforcement action on the two resolutions which called on Indonesia to withdraw its troops without delay. We know this because Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the former U.S. ambassador to the UN, wrote about it in his memoirs. That was the policy that started under Ford and Kissinger. Okay, and you continued that policy. So I have two questions. The first is, would you be willing to facilitate the full declassification of documents regarding what the Carter administration, your administration, did in East Timor by granting a waiver under the Privacy Act? And secondly, would you favor the convening for the case of East Timor, an international war crimes tribunal, along the lines of what has been done in Bosnia and Rwanda, along the lines of what President Bush called for in the case of Saddam Hussein in Iraq? And would you be willing to abide by its verdict in regard to your own conduct?
Richard Holbrooke responds.
First of all, we're not going to have time to deconstruct your question and take it on point by point here. We've got other questions and we need to get to them. But let me say very clearly, first of all, I don't accept every statement you've just made as fact. Far from it. Moynihan, for example, was not the ambassador during the Carter administration. He was the ambassador during the previous administration.
He started it under Ford and you continued that policy.
I don't think we're going to have time to deconstruct this here. I do not accept most of your statements. However, in regard to the last questions, of course I favor declassification. I have nothing to hide about my own role. If I made a mistake or two along the way, I'll confront it when that comes up. No one is error-free here. But just for the purpose of everyone else in the room, this is not an accurate description of the administration's policy or my own role in it.
What in particular is inaccurate?
If you want to have this discussion now, I think we're going to lose the rest of the afternoon. I think we ought to reserve it in detail. I just think that you should understand that it is simply not the way you described it. As I said in my opening remarks, Indonesia was an important country and remains an important country. And the solution to the problem, as I said to an earlier question, does not, in my view, involve a complete arms cutoff. You're welcome to disagree. But I am interested in consequences of policy. I'm interested in solving the problem.
The consequences in this case were genocide, a third of the Timorese population killed.
If you want to accuse me of genocide, you're welcome to do so. And if, as far as extending the war crimes tribunal to Timor, or for that matter, Cambodia, where it's incomprehensibly not have a mandate, I'm all for it. In fact, I've recently written a letter to the Holocaust Commission at the museum recommending that they take this issue on precisely because it's incomprehensible to me why various people who are equally as murderous as Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic have never been investigated. But I tell you here, for the benefit of everyone else, that the Timor issue is not as simple as described just now. It just isn't. This is not what happened, and I don't think anyone who knows Jimmy Carter or what he stands for would agree that this was a deliberate policy of giving low-flying airplanes or helicopters to the Indonesians so that they could go out and kill people in the hills.
Richard Holbrooke, responding to questioning by Alan Nairn at Brown University in 1997. Richard Holbrooke, who was after that U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, before that in the Carter administration, in charge of Asia policy in the State Department. And finally, before we go to State Department whistleblower who diverge from the administration view of Indonesia and East Timor, we are going to Henry Kissinger. In 1994, Alan Nairn and I had a chance to question the former Secretary of State, who, along with Gerald Ford, gave the green light for Indonesia to invade East Timor in 1975, the day before the invasion. He met with Suharto. This was Alan Nairn questioning Henry Kissinger.
Mr. Kissinger, my name is Alan Nairn. I'm a journalist from the United States. I'm one of the Americans who survived the massacre in East Timor on November 12, 1991, a massacre during which Indonesian troops armed with American M16s gunned down at least 271 Timorese civilians in front of the Santa Cruz Catholic Cemetery as they were gathered in an act of peaceful mourning and protest. Now, you just said that in your meeting with Suharto on the afternoon of December 6, 1975, you did not discuss Timor. You did not discuss it until you came to the airport. Well, I have here the official State Department transcript of your and President Ford's conversation with General Suharto, the dictator of Indonesia. It was obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. It has been edited under the Freedom of Information Act, so the full text isn't there. But it is clear from the portion of the text that is here that, in fact, you did discuss the impending invasion of East Timor with Suharto, a fact which was confirmed to me by President Ford himself in an interview I had with him. President Ford told me that, in fact, you discussed the pending invasion of Timor with Suharto, and that you gave the U.S. approval. That you and President Ford together gave U.S. approval for the invasion of East Timor. There is another internal State Department memo, which is printed in extensive excerpt here in an article which I'll give to anyone in the audience who was interested. This is a memo of a December 18, 1975 meeting held at the State Department. This was held right after you returned from that trip, and you were berating your staff for having put on paper a finding by the State Department legal advisor, Mr. Lee, that the Indonesian invasion of East Timor was illegal, that it not only violated international law, but violated an Indonesian treaty with the U.S. because U.S. weapons were used. And it's clear from this transcript, which I invite anyone in the audience to peruse, that you were angry at them, first, because you feared this memo would leak, and second, because you were supporting the Indonesian invasion of East Timor, and you did not want it known that you were doing this contrary to the legal advice of your own people in the State Department. If one looks at the public actions, 16 hours after you left that meeting. I'm getting to the question, sir. 16 hours after you left that meeting with Suharto, the Indonesian troops began parachuting over Dili, the capital of East Timor. They came ashore and began the massacre that culminated the genocide of a third of the Timorese population. You announced an immediate doubling of U.S. military aid to Indonesia at the time. And in the meantime, at the United Nations, the instructions given to Ambassador Daniel Patrick Moynihan, as he wrote in his memoirs, were to, as he put it, see to it that the UN proved utterly ineffective in any actions of the United on his team. The U.S. continued under your leadership. My question, Mr. Dr. Kissinger, is twofold. First, will you give a waiver under the Privacy Act to support full declassification of this memo so we can see exactly what you and President Ford said to Suharto? Secondly, would you support the convening of an international war crimes tribunal under UN supervision on the subject of East Timor? And would you agree to abide by its verdict in regard to your own conduct?
I mean, this sort of comment is one of the reasons why the conduct of foreign policy is becoming nearly impossible under these conditions. Here is a fellow who's got one obsession. He's got this one problem. He collects a bunch of documents. You don't know what is in these documents.
I invite the audience to read
them. Well, the reason, the fact is, essentially, as I described it, Timor was not a significant American policy problem. If Suharto raised it, if Ford said something that sounded encouraging, that's conceivable. It was not a significant American foreign policy problem. It seemed to us to be an anti-colonial problem in which the Indonesians were taking over Timor, and we had absolutely no reason at that time to pay any huge attention to it. Secondly,
so why did you not double
the military? Now I'm sorry. Secondly, you have to understand these things in the context of the period. Vietnam had just collapsed. Nobody yet knew what effect the domino theory would have. Indonesia is a country of a population of 160 million and a key country in Southeast Asia. We were not looking for trouble with Indonesia. And the reason I objected in the State Department to putting this thing on paper was precisely, and it wasn't that it was put on paper, it was that it was circulated to embassies, because it was guaranteed to leak out, it was guaranteed then to lead to some public confrontation, and for better or worse, our fundamental position on these human rights issues was always to try to see whether we could discuss them first quietly before they turned into a public confrontation. This was our policy with respect to emigration from Russia, in which we turned out to be right.
Henry Kissinger, responding to Alan Nairn's questions about 8 years ago for his role in the Indonesian occupation of East Timor. In the interest of time, we're not going to be able to go to our second break. We're going to move right on here. Alan Nairn, your response to Henry Kissinger had to say as we move on to the State Department whistleblower, who really laid out for the administration what was going on in Indonesia and East Timor.
Well, Kissinger was lying, of course. Just a few months ago, the full text of that State Department cable recording the Ford-Kissinger-Suharto meeting was declassified, and it showed that, yes, they indeed discussed the invasion, and Ford and Kissinger explicitly gave the green light. In fact, they even asked Suharto to wait until they had left town, and wait until they had left Indonesia before launching the invasion, so as not to make it so obvious that the U.S. was behind it.
Well, Alan, from the start, the U.S. offered crucial support for Indonesia's invasion and the quarter-century occupation of Timor. After the 91 Santa Cruz massacre, congressional and grassroots activists worked to cut off U.S. military support for Indonesia despite fierce resistance from the Bush and Clinton administrations. From 96 to 1999, however, East Timor's grassroots supporters had a crucial ally. He was a State Department official at the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta who consistently fought his own government and worked to change U.S. policy in support of East Timor. His name, Ed McWilliams, former political counsel at the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta.
Nice to be with you, Amy.
Alan. It's good to be with you, Ed McWilliams. Alan?
Ed McWilliams was the chief political officer in the embassy at the time, and he played a role that was remarkable. I've never seen it done by any State Department official in any other country. At a time when the U.S. Was closely enmeshed with the very repressive Indonesian military, he was pushing hard for democracy and human rights and also in Indonesia and self-determination in Timor. He was viciously attacked within the embassy by people from the Pentagon and the CIA and others, his other colleagues in the State Department. He became a pariah. His career was essentially ended because of it. And now that Timor is becoming independent, now that people are saying in retrospect Suharto was a dictator, I think Mr. McWilliams deserves some credit for the stance he took within the State Department at a time when he was going against the official line. I want to ask him, why did you do that? Why did you decide to argue within the State Department that the U.S. Should not be backing the Indonesian military?
Well, I think I'd have to answer honestly that I was largely informed, and I guess I'd have to say inspired, by the international activism that you referred to earlier in the program. I was very impressed with the marshaling of facts on the ground by ETAN, the East Timorese Action Network, and, of course, by Amy and by yourself. And when those facts were laid out, it seemed to me that it was critical that we get this understanding, this perception back to Washington. Of course, I was also inspired by the courage of the East Timorese people themselves, and I might say also the people of West Papua and Aceh, who were fighting what was very clearly a dictatorship and a very, very brutal military.
And now, at the time, you were one of the top officials at the embassy in Jakarta. What impact did your recommendations have? And you're saying that, well, you know, we should stop supporting the Indonesian military and should support a free vote in Timor. What kind of reaction did you get from your government colleagues?
Well, I think, to be fair, within the embassy, I think I had very little impact. That embassy for years had been dominated by an agenda that was essentially pro-Suharto, essentially serving Pentagon interests, and then, of course, serving the interests of large U.S. corporations in Indonesia. As a result, essentially, I was regarded as, well, you mentioned the word pariah. I think it was virtually that. But I think more importantly, insisting on at least getting facts out if analysis would not be allowed to be reported. At least I was allowed to put the facts out, some of them. And once these facts began accumulating in Washington, I think that there were some serious people back in Washington that began to have second thoughts about this policy, which we had been pursuing, essentially a pro-Suharto, pro-military policy, for 3 decades.
Now, Clinton, in the end, under severe congressional and public pressure, cut off the U.S. assistance to the Indonesian military as Timor was being burnt to the ground. That was in September of 99, after the vote. When did you in the embassy first see and start reporting in your internal cables and memos that, in fact, the Indonesian military was sponsoring the militias that were starting to terrorize the Timorese people? When did you first see that?
That reporting began in early 99, when I think essentially we saw the formation of militias beginning even before Habibi had decided to offer the referendum, that is to say in late 98. But because we had some very good political officers from my team out in East Timor, we picked up quite early the fact that these militias were being formed. And I was out there myself and in the wake of the Lekesa massacre, for example, and was able to report not only the obvious role of the militias, but the links between the militias and the TNI, which had, as we discovered, had established, were funding, and were even protecting these militias against occasional popular wrath because of what they were doing.
And in April, following the Lekesa church massacre and also following some of the rampages in Dili, Admiral Blair, the U.S. military commander for the Pacific, met with General Wiranto, the man who was running the operation, and basically declined to call for a halt in the militia rampages, and offered to have Wiranto come to his home as his guest, offered to keep pushing in Washington, lobbying Congress to give full military aid to the Indonesian military. What impact did this have?
I think you're really touching on
a meeting of Blair with Wiranto.
I think you're touching on a very critical problem here. That did transpire essentially as you described. But more importantly, I think we have to look at what went wrong with our policy there. The UN, in that blip that you had from Kofi Annan, I think realistically understood that they couldn't put UN forces into East Timor after the agreement on May 5th to essentially establish a UN presence there. It was just not possible to overcome Indonesian objection to putting forces in. As a result, I think it became our obligation, especially the United States, to insist that the Indonesian military perform as they had not performed in the past, which is to say to protect the peace in East Timor. We failed in that responsibility. We did not press the Indonesian military to operate as it should have been operating. The principal problem was, I think, the Pentagon. We had a divided policy. There were some in the State Department, even in Washington, who recognized the need to essentially compel the Indonesian military to end support for the militias and so on. But because the Pentagon would not take a tough line with the Indonesian military, we had a divided message coming to the Indonesian government and to the Indonesian military. And as a result, there was very little pressure during the summer leading up to the massacre of September 99 from the United States government. It was very, very unfortunate that it transpired in this way.
Ed McWilliams, right now the Bush administration is pushing hard to restore full military ties to Indonesia in the name of the so-called war on terror. What is your response to that?
This would be a terrible mistake, I think. We should understand that the Pentagon specifically has been pressing to overturn the congressionally imposed restrictions on aid to the Indonesian military since they were put on back in late 99. At this moment, I think allies of the Pentagon, elsewhere the administration, and the Pentagon itself, of course, are trying to exploit the situation of September 11, trying to use that as a pretext for resuming ties with the Indonesian military, when in fact, of course, the provisions that were set out in the restrictions in 99, the Leahy provisions, those restrictions should be maintained because essentially the Indonesian military and the Indonesian government has not fulfilled what the conditions set out in those in that legislation.
Finally, what is your view on the situation in recent years and currently in Aceh and West Papua, two other areas under Indonesian control, which even though Timor hasn't gotten much attention, it's gotten a little more attention than those two areas. What has the Indonesian military been doing in Aceh and West Papua?
Well, I think this is why history is so important. The tactics that are being employed by the Indonesian military in both West Papua and Aceh were essentially refined and developed in East Timor. We see the same use of torture and terror, essentially, to intimidate the local population. We see the formation of militias, particularly in West Papua now, by the TNI to act essentially as their cat's paw. We have to understand the Indonesian military has not changed, and its brutality still is worthy of our condemnation and certainly should prohibit any kind of cooperation with that institution.
Ed McWilliams, we only have 10 seconds, but I wanted to get your thoughts on what is about to happen this weekend, and that is East Timor's independence.
Well, I think, as Alan mentioned earlier, it's an inspiring start, and I think it's inspiration for the people of West Papua and Aceh and other repressed populations around the world. With international activism and the courage of the local people, changes can come about.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us and also let our community radio stations around the country know we will be doing a three-hour live broadcast on Sunday at the moment that East Timor becomes independent. Eastern Standard Time, we will air from 10 o'clock till 1 p.m. on the Pacifica satellite. That's 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., which corresponds with 11 o'clock p.m., Timor time until 2 in the morning. East Timor will become an independent nation at midnight on Sunday. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced in East Timor with Brad Simpson and Rick Ray in New York, Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, engineer Anthony Sloan. We want to also thank the whole video team for doing an incredible job, and we will be thanking them in the days to come by name. I'm Amy Goodman with Alan Nairn in Dili, East Timor. Thanks for listening. Tahan malih.